Thank you, guys. That was really interesting. It reminded me of what you were saying earlier about that it must have been from Factfulness when you go back to where South Africa is today to where Sweden was 30 years ago. It's incredible. It's hard to see if you are looking at it at a moment in time. But if we get real smart and go back and look at history, the United States, 1880 to 1922, was an incredible period. I think they called it the Gilded Age, the time where more millionaires or billionaires were created. Do you think that's possible in South Africa? Do you think we've got a momentum that's growing? Gigi, you said the unemployment rate is not 33%, as is said in official stats, but more like 12% in South Africa. You certainly don't see soup kitchens and long queues and violence erupting as you would at a 32% unemployment rate. Maybe you can both just talk to that. Are you seeing this creation of wealth transforming into something a lot bigger?
So I think the first thing is that there are incomes being earned by people at a level that we can't imagine.
Let me just check if that's on. Do you want it at the bottom? If you press it up? Yeah.
Hello?
There we go.
Is that now better? To repeat, there's incomes being developed at a level which we cannot imagine, and there's been a fundamental shift over time towards where people are increasingly saying, I want to be part of a hustle, or I want to, you know, have my own business. And it's quite interesting, you know, just as an aside, there's a baker that we work with this Supremes, a loyalty program for township bakers, and I asked the one guy, what did you do before this? And he said, I was the librarian at UNISA University, and I took my pension and I invested it into starting this bakery, which is a kind of little bakery in a little back residential street. And he sells, I think, 600 loaves of bread a day and rolls and cakes and stuff like that. And then he put his wife into a new bakery that he's set up. And I said, and how did you finance that? He said, I took more money out of my UNISA pension fund. And, I mean, he's doing well. He says he's doing better from the bakery than he did as the librarian at a university. And it's just a wonderful story. And in fact, a large portion of the people we see in this economy have actually left formal businesses and have benefited from the training and experience they had in a formal business and have now moved into this informal economy. The problem is he has to pull out of his pension fund. And in Africa, we see businesses start small and stay small. And this is one of the fundamental issues that will stop us having this level of the Gilded Age of fundamentally shifting those. I think if we can liberate various forms of support and grants and funding and loan ability to businesses, it'll be transformative and we would see a radical change. And there are none of these things. And so it always needs a spark. You know, what is a spark to enable that? The entrepreneurs, the tech sector, we look at it as a lot of venture capital availability and stuff, but people in this kind of space don't have it. And I think that we're literally at the cusp of this sector going crazy and growing. If people like Kheri Furi at Capitec are saying this keeps him awake at night, trust me, start looking at that sector because those guys are the real street fighters of our business.
Alec, I think it's more than just solving unemployment and earning income. It's all the ancillary work that goes into wealth creation that's needed as well. You know, so it's the financial advice. What do you do with the profits you're making? How do you reinvest it into the economy? How do we get capital flowing and not just leaving those economies? And that's one of the things AltFest is trying to do by creating the circularity of capital, attaching advice to it, heritage building and wealth planning and financial management are all disciplines that people are learning on the job. And, you know, it all goes hand in hand with being excluded from financial markets. It's not just capital, and it's not just access to loans and other financial services products. It's the entire regime change that's needed, and those are the things we work in.
Maybe thought change as well, because we are a highly politicized country. We've got an election coming up in 2 weeks, and we have a socialist party that rules us and is probably going to get the most votes. Is that ever going to change, or what would it? What, you know, the Americans had an advantage. They unlocked human potential with their founding fathers. Our founding fathers are almost holding back the human potential. What might be the catalyst there?
So I think that the mistake we make is that, you know, we don't realize how entrepreneurial and how free market or capitalist people are in these spaces. We kind of assume, because that's what the politicians say, that people kind of follow that, and that's actually been the voice of the masses that have spoken to socialism and that kind of thing. Whereas the reality is that the vast, and even in the depths of apartheid, people opened illegal shebeens, opened spaza shops. The taxi industry came out of nothing and was illegal and overtook the Patco bus services and stuff like that. And that hasn't changed. And the reality is the vast proportion of people that I speak to are kind of like, we know that the government isn't going to help us. We know that you know, all the things like load shedding has really given a massive negative impact on the informal sector. If you think it was bad on the formal, you must know on that sector. So, you know, people have kind of said, no, we're not interested in this. We're just going to carry on ourselves. And I think that that resilience and the ability to survive that and to kind of believe we're independent is going to be the saving grace, because people aren't reliant on this kind of sector. There's no BEE in the sector. You know, people have just gone on and done their thing. So there's this emerging sense, and COVID accelerated it as well. We're seeing across a number of different factors this growth of like, you're on your own and you need to make it happen.
How effective was social distancing in the townships during COVID?
We had sessions about it. In fact, there's a report done by the UCT Liberty Institute, part of the University of Cape Town. There's a report done in end of 2022, I think it was. It was said, "Thriving, not striving: how the black middle classes have how the black middle class are doing." It was fascinating. There's 3.5 million black middle class individuals, which is a million more than the white middle class individuals. But one of the things they said is that the impact of COVID did not affect 80% of the black middle classes, as which could not be said about the white middle classes. Why was that? If you wanted your hair done in the suburban areas, the formal environment, you couldn't go to the hair salon. In the township, the hair salon is someone's back room. You wandered down the road. The fast food outlet closed the front and kept the back open. And in fact, they said that the police and army who were patrolling the streets were their biggest customers. You know, so we saw the reality is most of this informal economy is in the residential areas, is within these environments. And so very little impact. And that's not only my experience, but people like UCT Liberty, who said, you know, very little impact of COVID. This also shows their resilience, their ability to tighten their belts, their ability to make alternative plans. Load shedding is an example. Their alternative plans of a baker in the townships wasn't to get a generator, was to wake up at 3 a.m. when they said the power came back on, or to have two bakeries, one in one township, one in the other, because then when this bakery was having load shedding, they literally shifted to the other one. These amazing resilience and ability to survive, which is really entrepreneurial. And so, you know, they are able to withstand shocks better.
That was such a long answer. I forgot the question.
But let me ask you about this. Warren, if you could invest in Tabaseng's business, I mean, those returns are quite extraordinary. You were talking to Sean Pesh a little bit earlier. And just repeat that story, and let's see if Warren would be interested in investing in that kind of a return on investment.
I think Sean was talking about the return on it, saying, and this is very true. So if you build a set of, say, three back rooms, most people have this house, and at the back there's generally a relatively more amount of space than you would realize in a township. And most people build 3 or 6 rooms, these little 6 by 3 meter rooms, and it'll cost you between 30 up to 80,000 rand to build these units. And you're renting them out for 3,000 rand each. So work out, let's say it costs you 80.
Per month, 3,000 rand.
3,000 rand each. So if you've got 3, you're making 9,000 rand. It costs you either between 40, let's call it 40 and 80,000 rand to build, depending on the level of tiling and stuff that you do inside this unit and whether it's an outside shower or an inside one. But anyway, it costs you 80,000 rand to build it, let's say, and you rent out 6 of them for 3,000 rand each. It's a pretty good return on capital.
So your PE in Sean's terms is under 1, less than 1.
Yeah.
Would you invest in something like that, Warren? Can you with AltVest?
So it's obviously those are very small scale investments, and to talk to someone like an asset manager out of London, it's almost impractical to even have the discussion unless you've solved for the infrastructure around getting large amounts of capital into investments like that. And the way we've addressed that is a portfolio approach where we've made up baskets of hundreds or thousands of these. So it's like a unit trust of township businesses, in effect. So you don't get single asset exposure in the first instance. And these large portfolios are capable of accepting large amounts of capital that can be quickly deployed to the entrepreneurs. So we aren't asking pension funds to, you know, join and invest in Tubby Singh's backroom business or a little bakery or a butcher or baker or candlestick maker. It's really portfolio approaches, and those are with different themes. So AltVest will ultimately have a township economy portfolio. We'll have an agriculture portfolio, a solar portfolio, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, we've got a credit fund that is ready to go. Those are the stats we've deployed, and we're able to receive large allocations from pension funds, wherever they may be, to be deployed as funding solutions to SMEs. So that's the approach we'll be taking so that we can invite institutional participation from worldwide investors.
Now, Mohammed Yunus started with Grameen Bank, and I know you guys know the story very well, with very, very, very small loans, and why he was successful was because those people repaid their loans. What is your experience?
We've had almost zero defaults. Look, it has only been 6 months. But we also don't offer unsecured lending. Not that we want to collect a basement full of people's personal artifacts, but we find that where people take personal surety, it creates the right lending and credit behavior. And so we're insistent on that, whether it's grandma's jewels all the way through to your favorite car. We find that it brings out the correct credit behavior from people. And that responsibility is quite evident in a number of other characteristics that we also look at in our credit assessment. You know, just how people conduct themselves in the application process is very informative. You know, the time they take to compile financial statements or their reports or just the look and feel of the business. All of these things are instructive in making credit decisions. And for now, we've got a great book that's operating effectively. It's been paid back, but The biggest issue was a change in how we looked at risk, and not the SME's fault. We had to look at risk differently, and you know, there's I forget the practitioner or an American CEO who was having a chat with his HR head of HR, who was complaining that, you know, we spend a fortune on training people. What if we train them all and they leave? And his response was, well, what if we don't train them and they stay? And my approach to, or our approach to lending is, you know, banks will often ask, or credit committees will ask, what happens if we give them the money? And our question and the way we look at risk is, what happens if we don't? You know, And it's a very fundamentally different approach to how capital markets in South Africa and across the world, we believe, approach risk. And that is something we've had to change the way we look at the world in the hopes of being impactful and in the hopes of improving the country.
What about tax? And this is working on a question that Wendy put forward. If you are extending money, you're taking a risk, you need to have some kind of formalized, presumably, financial statements, which would then suggest taxes would be paid somewhere along the line, or how do you approach that?
So I've got a long story about tax, but I'll come back to it. Let's start with, and sorry to have, remember what his question was, so then I'm finished. So if we look at the... if we look at the kind of retailers, the spaza shop, the alcohol tavern, the fast food outlet and stuff, there's been this incredible shift towards card acceptance. I've worked recently with BankServe, which is the underlying banking infrastructure for the banks, for card acceptance and so on. Worked on a product recently that's an instant phone-to-phone payments system. But if we look at card acceptance, I've just finished a project with MasterCard. And if you look at card acceptance, currently within the township economy, you have about 40% of all transactions are now a card transaction, where someone comes to an informal shop, tap their card for payment, or tap their card and do what they call cashback, which is cash withdrawal. I was, in fact, involved with a listed company called Asaka, who wanted to develop a township digitization index. It was recently in the news, and what they showed was they had 70,000 card acceptance devices in 70,000 informal businesses around South Africa. In 2001, they had 0% card acceptance. But end of 2003, they had 42% card acceptance. That was R1 billion a month of card acceptance. So they do R2 billion worth of turnover a month across those 70,000 outlets. R1 billion of that within this period of 3 years was now card acceptance, which just shows you the incredible growth. And I predict that, in fact, I was with one of the top banks a while ago, 2 weeks ago, and I had said to them, I predict... So I've said in the past, I predict that cash will go from about 70% now to about 30-40% within 3 years. But sitting with the bank, I said to them, I think 3 to 5 years. They said, don't forget about 5 years. 3 years, we will be 40% cash. That is a very important thing, because what it means is that as money is moving onto the system, forget about cash. What can happen is you now have a financial record. And companies who have these devices, people like Ikorka, Yoko, and many others, Capitec in particular, are starting to extend loans on the basis of that these are working capital loans. It's not to, you know, build a block of flats, but they're basically saying, if you're, we'll track your card acceptance over 6 months or 3 months or a year, whatever the amount of money is, and we will take 1% of every single transaction as repayment over your payment period. So you won't even feel this thing. And they're extending can be 40, 50, 100 million rand at a time across many outlets being extended. So now you suddenly have the ability for these outlets to get working capital deducted in 1 or 0.5% increments from every transaction. What it happens now is that if they say to the spaza shop or the tavern owner or the fast food outlet, we'll give you R1 million working capital loan, but we need to see R1 million a month or whatever going through your card. He suddenly says to the person who's bringing their cash, their wad of cash, I don't want your cash. Why don't you rather pay by card and I'll give you, you know, R5 off this transaction? So there's a real incentive and a very rapid move towards digitization of this kind of space. And tax is the least of people's problems. People are not in cash because they are trying to escape the tax man. In fact, the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, did some research called the SMME Voice 2 years ago. They asked traders, why do you operate in cash? 2% of them said, because I don't want to pay tax. The vast proportion said, I don't have an alternative. I can't access a device that will allow me to accept card payments. So we're going to see that dramatic shift happen.
You mentioned Lesaka. We've had actually a couple of good, insightful recommendations. In the BizNews portfolio, we've got that stock in. I think it was from your last recommendation. It's up 30% in 6 months, listed on the NASDAQ and on the JSE. So, and that's your way into the informal market directly.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. Okay, can I get into some of these questions? A lot of anecdotes of consumption industries, beauty, fast food, housing. What about the manufacturing and value-added production sectors? What lens would you place on manufacturing for the informal economy? It's from Justin. Do you want to start, Warren?
We are able and willing to provide loans and funding to manufacturing. There aren't many that have approached us, unfortunately. The closest we've gotten is, you know, some construction businesses, for example, the student accommodation. But actual manufacturing is not something that most SMEs take on, given the high level of infrastructure investment required and also the lack of capital. We're hoping that starts to change as people start seeing capital become available. But you know, most of these informal businesses are quite capital light, given that people have to be quite nimble and that kind of stuff. I think as the infrastructure builds around it, you'll start seeing people get more and more into businesses like this. But they need to see at least the signs of growth of financial infrastructure around them before they start looking at those. But right now, you know, the capital intensity is limited to, you know, stoves, small cranes, small lifts, those kinds of things to do small maintenance or repair work. But no one can really afford the installation of assembly lines or anything like that as yet.
Yeah, so, I mean, livestock is production. An interesting figure. If you look at just the goat industry in South Africa, we import 500 million rands worth of goats from Botswana and Namibia a year. We consume in various forms about 4.4 billion rands worth of goats, of which 1% of that 4.4 billion rand comes from commercial farmers. So the rest is coming from that sector. If you look at small-scale construction, here's one of the issues. You know, there's I did some work with a mattress manufacturer and said, oh, we can't penetrate this township space. Do you have any reason why? I was like, yeah, there's more mattress manufacturers in the townships who will refurbish or make you a brand new mattress at a third of the price. And they said, no, we want to see it. And we went around and we went to people's back rooms where they'd have this like shelter. And they'd had a state-of-the-art mattress manufacturing. The guy had worked for Ed Blow for 20 years and then went and started his mattress business. Mattresses, aluminium windows, chrome gutters, cupboards. And, you know, so people buy the raw material from listed companies like PG Bison, who will tell you 60% out of their sales, if I can't remember the exact number, are going into townships where people are taking raw materials, manufacturing them. So you know, it is in certain factors. It's generally small scale. The mattress guy, he's got one machine. He spent a lot of money on this. It's quite elaborate. I never realized this. And he makes one mattress every 2 or 3 days. He should have a factory. But, you know, how does he finance that? He's financed it. All of that finance of any of those businesses, there's a lady, Alicia, in the township of Togoza, who does aluminium windows and doors. And she's gone from supplying small-scale township, the local people in the township with their doors and windows, to where she's now supplying. When I saw her a few months ago, she was doing a job for about 500,000 rand for a block of flats or something in Krugersdorp. And she said her biggest problem was that she had to get all of this raw material to be able to manufacture. She's got the capacity to do 500,000 rand, but how does she get the money? And so this, again, is one of the limitations. They're certainly there. It's really a matter of scale. And there's a lot more than you realize in terms of stuff being manufactured from raw materials. in that space.
So the opportunities are just vast. The way you've been unpacking it, and we can see that in future. Last question, banking from Jenny. Banking the informal economy and a cashless society, a key barrier is the effort and dangers associated to handling cash. Could you talk about the opportunity for Monzo stroke Vimo type offering? Why has a banking product like this not been developed, particularly since our banking sector is so sophisticated, where money is passed via telephone numbers and it is truly cashless and investments are now an extension of them, particularly relevant in more rural areas?
So if we're talking, I don't know those products, but let's talk about mobile banking and stuff like that. So the mobile money transfer industry is incredibly big. I couldn't tell you the amounts of money in terms of money spent sent around, but there's a huge number of Makuru, M-Pesa, Mama Money, EcoPay and so on and so forth. So a huge amount. So the Zimbabwe guy in South Africa sending money home using Mama Money, which is a little app on his phone. But very little of it has been transactional like a product like M-Pesa. M-Pesa in East Africa and West Africa is the largest form of mobile money anywhere in the world in terms of transactional numbers and total amounts. It's quite an extraordinary product. Incredibly sophisticated. Most parts of East Africa now, you don't have to carry cash. You'd use M-Pesa. In South Africa, I was part of a banking initiative to launch a product called PayShap. PayShap is, in essence, instant payment from your bank account to someone else's bank account using your phone number as a proxy, and it's instant payment across banks. So if you EFT, it takes 12 to 24 hours to reflect. With PayShap, you pay it instantly. So we literally launched it, or the banking sector launched it in March this year. It will probably be the largest form of payment along with cards. Both of them, between the two of them, will dominate, and we will have, as I said, very low amounts of cash. Cash is a high risk but a very expensive product. But the primary reason it moves away from that is just the inefficiency of cash and being able to send and whatever. So between PayShap, if you look at, there's a product called UPI in India, United Payments Initiative, completely transformed the Indian market. Pax in Brazil, the same, which is a phone instant using your phone number to phone number instant payments. We've launched it in South Africa, part of the banking industry. We were way ahead of the game in many ways, but generally people don't know about these things.
And that must play to your sweet spot, Warren. If you've got that kind of a payment system and you've got that kind of information for the companies, then you've got something to base your credit decisions on.
Yeah, and one of the ways we have had to relearn how to assess credit is using different data points. And these kinds of deposits, these kinds of transfers, gives us alternative insights into customer financial behavior and different data points that we can use. So absolutely, we look at those. And we look at a number of different data points to arrive at a credit decision that is outside of what banks and other finance houses look at. All at still trying to be responsible, understanding always that we are managing other people's money, and that we have to be responsible. Even though our endeavors are good and we're looking to make an impact, we still need to return capital to our investors.
Warren Wheatley, Gigi Alcock, thank you.